Hello everyone, welcome to the Game Engineering Podcast. Today I am joined by Kacper Kędzi Leśniak, a game developer working at Dynasty Studios and my lifelong friend. He joins me to discuss our roots in programming and in game development, a mobile game called Stellar Asylum. During this episode you will hear me saying that we lost our code for Stellar Asylum forever. It's actually not the case. Managed to find it. Build the game, and hopefully by this time it will be both on App Store and Google Play for you to download. I hope you enjoy the episode.
Let's start with how Stellar Asylum looked like. I will give you this first. Let's do it like this. You paint the picture and I will fill in the details.
All right. So, yeah, Stellar Asylum was, or is, a mobile game. It's still available. You can still download it on the Play Store. That we made 8 years ago, or we started making 8 years ago, and we released 7 years ago. And it was a mobile game where you played in multiplayer on one mobile device. So that was our idea, our unique selling point, you can say, that we wanted to play on one even mobile phone with small screen with multiple people at the same time. And the kind of center of the design was that the map will be circular with everybody on the one corner of the mobile device having a button to control whatever character they have. And then the map in the center would be, you know, circular, so it would be the same from every side, so nobody would have it upside down, if you can imagine it. And the theme of the game was science fiction. It was a 2207 AD in the space station where mad prisoners were kept, and the prisoners, something went wrong. Something went wrong, the cells of the prisoners opened, and then the prisoners started fighting to regain their freedom. And it was basically a deathmatch, right? Every round was maybe a minute long, maybe 2 minutes long, sometimes 10 seconds long. And it was just the last person standing, winning the round. Then for winning a round, you would get a point, and then for X amount of points, you would win the whole game.
Yeah, so and having this view, like 2D view, you had only one button to control your character, and you needed to perform all of the activities by pressing this button. So if you tapped once, you would flip the direction that you're moving in. If you tap twice, you would jump, and if you would hold the button, tap and hold, you would activate a special ability, and each character had their own unique special ability, which was pretty nice. Pretty nice.
Yeah, and also everybody was moving all the time. Everybody was running, like in Endless Runners. So basically, your character would keep running until you flipped the direction of the movement. And because of it, the game was dynamic. In a way, because if nothing was happening, everybody was still running and something was happening on the screen.
Yeah, and the station, like the prison, the space station, the circular one, had lasers, like two kinds of lasers, like two kind of systems of defenses. One was the laser that they stunned you, generally. They just kept you in place when they hit you. And then there was the special kind, the more murderous one, when only two people remained, two characters remained in the game. The lightning lasers would activate, the zappers, I think. Zappers, we call them.
Yeah, something like that.
So
yeah.
they zapped prisoners, characters running around. And if you were zapped, you actually died and lost the match. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
We had four prisoners, as we call them, or initially four, then five. So our characters were called prisoners. We had Steven, who was an astronaut with a bazooka, I guess. There was a rhino, who was basically a rhino who would charge and kill people while running. There was Todachi, who was a frog in a space costume controlling a remote bomb. Yeah. And there was Fuzzy, who was a monkey who would jump on the ceiling and run around the ceiling and kill people by jumping on them.
Yeah, and the fifth one then?
Yeah, then the fifth one, the premium one that you had to pay for, was called Rena? Rena?
Yeah, Rena, I guess the English Rena. English would be Rena.
Yeah, Rena, who had two states, a fire state and a freeze or cold state. And based on the state, either she would shoot after jumping or she would stun people when jumping over them. And all of those abilities, mind I remind you, were all controlled by one button. So it was kind of a challenge, right? To both design characters, which would be fully controllable by one button, but also programmatically we had to deal with a lot of things. Just around controlling it. And
what was our naming scheme? How did we come up with names for the characters?
Zero idea. I think when we started, it was called Astronaut, right? The first character.
Okay.
But we thought at some point we decided that it can't be just called Astronaut. So somebody was like, yes, Steven. Steven sounds good. And then it remained. I think this was our naming scheme. Like whatever funny name somebody said, and then it stick.
Yeah, because we were learning programming and game development as well on this project, like during this project. So the first code, like proper code I wrote, was for this project. So like it wasn't apparent to us. And it wasn't such a common idea like 8 years ago that you should have a proper variables, for example, and proper names for everything. So like I remember that I for the script that was slightly rotating the space station, I called it Rotatos Potatos. It's
Rotatos Potatoes.
It wasn't such an obvious idea that you should call them like vaguely like not humoristically at least.
Yeah. But, yeah, because to just paint this picture, we were 19 or 18 when we started doing this.
Yeah.
We started it right after high school during the vacation before university started. And we had zero experience with code. So first things that we wrote pretty much ever were part of our code base, sometimes up until the very end. And you can imagine that it wasn't a great piece of software, and it was quite a miracle that it worked at the end, right? But I think it was very, very interesting that we stumbled upon the actual problems that people deal with in software engineering, and then we either figured out ourselves how to solve them, or somebody maybe, you know, hinted us how to solve the problems.
Yeah,
I remember one of the things was polymorphism. I don't know if you remember, but basically after developing the first character, Steven, we were like, okay, so now we want to have more characters. But how does it work? Like Steven is one class and we want to have Rhino, for example, which will be separate class, but we still want to have some code that kind of deals with both of them at the same time. So do we have one prisoner class and then part of this class is for Rhino, part of this class is for Steven, and then we just have like million ifs for each action and for each variable. And I think we couldn't find an answer. So I contacted my older brother, who was already, he's like 7 years older than me. He was already a software engineer at the time. And we're like, yeah, but how to solve it? It's such a hard problem. And he wrote like three solutions, which were pretty basic, all of them. It was either a templated method or polymorphism, or third one was some sort of map of behaviors, if I remember correctly, with lambdas. But like, we barely understood the words in this, in what he said. But after reading up on it, we were like, yeah, polymorphism, right? That's basically exactly the answer that we need. We just need a prisoner class and then a rhino class, whatever Steven class that we're inheriting from it. And it was like, somebody actually solved it. How crazy is it, right?
Yeah, it was a revelation. I remember looking up like, what is this inheritance? And like, how you have two things, and like, the one thing is kind of a part of the other, but like in a special way. It's, I remember looking up and learning this way. This was really nice. Like it's funny that like we realized this in this such a, like we first had a problem to solve, and then we needed a solution. And then like the solution, the problem was that was driving this, right? If you go to university and you learn stuff, it's like, so here's inheritance. And like, if you're really like young and didn't try to do things, to code things, you don't know why would you ever use this, right? Like, or when would you use this, and when would you use the other things, right? And we were learning through first like encountering real problems, and then and then somebody offered us as a solution. This was really nice way of learning that.
I remember object-oriented programming classes in university were always, you know, the examples from real life with a car and you know, a light bulb and things like that, which doesn't really make sense in terms of, sure, maybe they explain the problem in a theoretical way, but you're like, all right, but we're doing software, so how does it even connect with that? And and having it actually solve a problem in your code, which you were struggling with for the last month or so, it's it really makes you remember it forever.
What are the technical things you recall about Star Asylum?
Version control, let's say. was kind of a technical or organizational thing.
Yeah,
right?
That's true.
Do you remember how we started?
How we started? No, I remember the issues we had later on.
The first thing we did, we created a project in Unity, by the way. It was Unity Engine, and I just made the project. I think I started, or we started it together. I think we met, right? Three of us. We started, I don't know, we created a project, created the first class, added some, I don't know, 2D basic assets, and then we zipped it and put it on Dropbox or Google Drive or whatever we used at the time. And then we went home and everybody downloaded it, unzipped it, and started working on it.
Yeah, and then was the exchanging issue. Like, we realized that, you know, like, three people working on the same thing, exchanging zip files, it's not really like the ideal solution for sharing this code. And then, but how did we like realize that we should use Git? I don't know. Like, this idea.
That was actually the university. So,
nice.
It was the one of the first courses we did was course of project group work or something like that, or tools for project group work was it called, I think. And we basically learned version control there, and we were like, all right, this Git program, I think we can use it for our project, right? So we set up Git. After 3 months of working on the project, or 4 months.
Yeah. And our main issue with Git, I think, was that we didn't realize that with Git you need to know about the .gitignore file. So all of the build files, all of the logs, all of the generated stuff, everything went into the repository. And with each commit and in each push, we push like tons of new stuff.
We didn't really have any reviews, right? It was just pushing to the main all the time, and so you would see a new commit, you had no idea what was in this commit, because when you opened it, it was 10,000 files and most of them auto-generated by Unity. And so we did this, and we quickly realized that the space on our hosting platform was running
out.
Yeah,
also
right?
I think Git as a software has the limit of 2 gigabytes for the files for the repository, and you can extend it with the Git large file support, Git LFS.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have like a additional repository, there's something else, but they blend in quite nicely. But you need to like first understand that and know about that. And we just thought that our project is growing so much and this game is becoming so huge that even the Git cannot handle this. And what was the solution? What is the solution?
So our solution was to just create a new repository,
yeah.
Name it Stellar Asylum 2,
yeah.
And put all the files there, because we noticed that the biggest folder was .git folder, right? Because it holds history for all of our binaries and auto-generated files that we had. So we were like, okay, if we don't copy .git, we just copy everything else, well, we can create a fresh repository and just start anew.
Yeah,
and we still didn't know about Gitignore.
Yeah, and now I don't think, because now Unity has a feature to have the scene files to save scene files as text files, and you have our prefab files also as text files. So if you run into a conflict, you have somewhat better chance of resolving it. Like ideally you would still avoid conflicts on scene files and prefabs. Now you have I think back then we didn't have even an option to do this, so all of the stuff was binary. So even if you
remember we had, you know, I think really? We had, we yeah. just didn't understand it. Yeah, yeah. I remember merging some text, or maybe I'm confusing it with a different Unity project I did, but
okay,
yeah, it's been for the feature was there for quite some time.
Yeah, but then like merging this file, you have like even like a text file, but you just all of it's like numbers and references to each other. Like ideally, you would avoid conflicts on prefabs. I don't know whether I think we used branches though, right? We didn't do code reviews, like pull requests, because this was like, was too advanced feature for us. But I think we use branches and just like merge them willy-nilly and like, look, there's this feature, and like the other person was supposed to like, after the code was pulled, was realized, okay, now this is how the feature works. Somebody told me that it's now supposed to work this way. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I think we ended up with what, 4 repositories at the end? I think we had Stellar Asylum 2. Then we moved to a different hosting page because we were like, okay, maybe something wrong with the Bitbucket or whatever we used at that time. Maybe let's try a different one. And also we had Stellar Asylum 2. Wasn't the last one like Stellar Asylum 3 or something?
Yeah, yeah. I
think you checked it.
I3. Yeah. 3 was the last one, but I don't know whether we started counting with 1 or 0. So like 3 or 4, at least like migrations to a new thing. But from the technical perspective, I want to discuss the animations, because now when I recall this, like this is really nice and like a fresh thing when you see it. So usually when you do 2D animations, you have like either sprite sheets, right? Sprite sheets, or you paint, or you do, and sprite sheet is like a grid of frames, and in each frame you have exact position how it should be displayed, like 2D PNG kind of a bitmap, and so then if there is an animation, like you swap at each frame, you swap the exact hand painted usually image. And you have like, okay, so for the frame 3, we have this pose, and then frame 4, we have another pose. So there's no like linear interpolation of stuff. But in order, you need to create whole sprite sheet for all of the animations. So like if you're having character running, you need to do like all of the running poses. If you jump, then you need to do jump poses. and like shooting is the same stuff. So in order to avoid this, you can do the rig, right? And you can pretty much paint the character once, then you add bones to it. So you start usually from like belly, tummy, and then you just add bones to legs, arms, and then you use something called inverse kinematics to modify the sprite that is close to the bone when you move the bone. So then you can animate the bones and the sprite parts like hands or legs are moving with the bones. But we did something different, and this was really interesting to see now because we used the rigging approach, but we didn't really modify the sprites too much, I think. So what we did, we had
We
like,
didn't at all.
yeah, I think we tried it at some point, and just did, like we realized, okay, this is becomes like corrupted if you stretch it too much, and like we should do something else. So our characters may look a little bit goofy. But I think it's like speaks to the comic accent of the comic accents of the Stellar Asylum, but each of the part like related to the bone is actually hand painted separately and then mushed together in the engine and animated regarding the bone. So you cannot really stretch your arm, but you can move it. So they're like running in this funny way, like with their arms, but not really, like you can extend them, but you cannot really reach somewhere. And this is really funny to look back at it. It's like it's such a unique animation now if you compare
It
it to
looks
everything
like
else.
a basically looks like a deliberate art choice that we
Yeah.
made, right? In order to make the game look exactly how we wanted. But the truth is, we didn't know how to do it, right? I think we used at the very end, I think we did integrate inverse kinematics too, because inverse kinematics is when you move the bones, instead of moving each bone separately and animating it, you grab a point at the end of a hand, for example, and stretch it out to grab something. I think we did integrate it at the very end, but still without any stretching or sprite modification, right? So it was inverse kinematic connected with basically a sprite that was kind of fixed in size. And it was a bit tough to animate. I remember all of us animated. It was also fun. We didn't
Yes.
really pick the animator. It was just, okay, I guess I'm doing death animations, you are doing shooting animations, and a third person is doing some running animation.
Yeah. Because we also probably can mention that we did this game as three people. Both us worked mostly on like programming, probably you more on like also design and narrative aspects. I'm more on the programming part, but also we had our third friend who was doing the art stuff, so both painting. I think he handled most of the animation anyway, or maybe I'm having fuzzy memories. But yeah, all of the characters were hand painted by him, who also didn't have any background in art or anything. He just like, okay, this is what we have to do. Like we're making a game, so we have to have like a visual aspect. So I'm taking this part. Yeah.
Yeah, I think he handled it really, really well. The art re looks really nice, but it also took ages, right? Because he didn't have much experience. It would just take a long time, which means that we were kind of scraping by with as few assets as possible, right? Just few, yeah, exactly, right? Like few poses for each character. Like four animations per character, I think. So it was running, jumping, and the special ability, right? And that was pretty much it. And dying, sorry, and dying so far.
Yeah, but then for example, if we needed like an icon of a character to for the character selection, we reused the head part. Like we did like, but I think that's I think we already like this is a lesson that you need to learn as a junior like game designer or like a game developer in general, that you will always be constrained by the amount of number of raw assets that you need for the game. So the more you can reuse in a really like smart way, not to make it too bland, like too samey on every scene, the more you can reuse your assets, the more productive you'll be. Because this is like, you know, with the advent maybe of Gen AI, it might change a bit, but you really want to have a lot of high quality assets for the dream game. You would have just like a number that is exceeding, let's say, the reality, right? So you need to make trade-offs for the assets here and there.
And it's a truth for both for indie devs and for AAA games, right? There is no difference, pretty much. So I don't know, the first example that comes to my mind is Diablo. Even in Diablo 4, right, a new game with thousands of people working on it, there are monsters that look exactly the same, have pretty much the same behavior in different parts of the map, in different acts, on different difficulties. And all that changes is their name and maybe the color of their armor or something, right? And maybe they have one different ability or something like that. So there is really no wrong in just reusing everything you have, slightly modifying it, and then producing more content with it. Because it's always going to be a bottleneck, right? You cannot just create 30 different characters with full models, with full textures, animations, and everything.
Yeah, that's why often also we can reuse the animations themselves, right? So like all of the positions of bones, if you keep the same skeleton for a different character, you can usually get away with having the same animation. Obviously, if like you see 20 people running or riding a horse, for example, in Witcher 3, and all of the horses look exactly the same, have the same animation, you will see this because it will look artificial, right? But slight variations in this animation, in this one animation, will probably let you do the job properly.
Yeah.
What was also fun about Star Asylum? What do you remember?
UI and UX. So, of course, we had no idea about UI and UX, right? We were three programmers on our first year of university, and we wanted to be special, you know? We wanted to be funny and unique. So one of the ideas we had was to not name the buttons in the menu normally as a sane person would do, but name them in a funny way. So what did we have? Instead of like when you first booted up the game, you didn't have a play button. You had, what was it? Enter prison, right?
Yes, enter prison. You needed to know that.
Enter prison.
Yeah, imagine opening up a game and you have like the first option is enter prison, and you probably don't have any context. Why would you like to enter prison? Because like the game is called Stellar Asylum, so it's not obvious that this is like a prison, because asylum is not the same thing. So you boot up the game, you have like a space station picture and like enter prison as the first one. And after a couple of years, when I opened it up, I genuinely didn't know what to click. And it was like a revelation. It was a revelation that like I fooled myself. My past self fooled me.
Yeah. And then you click enter prison. And it's not getting easier after you click it, because then you have two choices, and one choice is total slaughter.
Yes.
And the second choice is team abomination.
Yes.
what you're gonna pick, you don't know.
Yes. And the idea.
Go for it.
The idea was that total slaughter is just one versus all. And the team abomination, you play as teams, 2v2. But again, like, no context. Like, we could have even, like, have parentheses and say, like, 1v all and 2v2. Mm-hmm. And it, but I think the whole point was to be, like, unique in this regard and not to do what everyone else is doing. Yeah.
Yeah. And then we had one more funny thing in our options menu, which is actually a thing, if you remember, that put us on one of the top voted posts in one of the subreddits for the Android gaming.
Android itself. I don't know.
No, I think it was Android gaming where okay. we got the most upvotes. And it wasn't even us posting it. It was somebody, right? Yeah. Who played the game randomly and took a screenshot of our options menu because inside there was a useless slider or pointless slider, was it?
Yeah, there was like a slider for music, slider for sound they actually worked. Like you could turn the volume, change the volume. And then there was the third one, which was pointless slider. And it was like a, just there.
Yeah. Yeah. Another brilliant joke that definitely most the gaming made the gaming experience much better, right?
I mean, this one is like a gag, and like you know, I would be let's say frustrated or annoyed if I would need to tweak some setting and would just drown in settings, and half of them would be like pointless sliders. This would be an awful experience, but like. We had only two sliders. We didn't have too much settings in the game. So it was just like...
Yeah, and I think it was kind of easy to understand that in the game settings, sometimes you have billion settings for everything, which are needed, right? Accessibility is a very important thing. But for us back then, it was a nice way to make a joke about it. And somebody liked it apparently and posted it and it got like 1,000 upvotes, which we didn't realize until like 5 years later, right? Yeah. When somebody dug it up on Android gaming for some reason.
What were the other options? The menu options? Do you remember whether we included like more names? Like what was the exit thing? We had a special thing for exit. Okay.
I can very quickly check. But I still have it installed. I'm one of 40 people, 50 people who have it installed. Oh shit, I don't have it installed right now. I was changing phones and I don't have it.
You're not supporting our project now. Yeah, the one thing.
Okay.
Yeah, one thing to notice that it's only available Android platforms on the Android Play Store, because an App Store, it's usually, first of all, you need a Mac to create, or you need Xcode, which is only a native application for Mac, and Apple is generally pursued back then, and now it's also in the Android world, but they pursued heavily the requiring signing your application with the proper keys, and then the fees for using the App Store are higher than Android. So we could, I think we paid like $100 for Android.
Yeah,
$100
for the developer account.
For developer account for like entirety of our lives, right? And for App Store, I think it's a similar amount, but for a year. And then you need to, if you develop something, you need to go into like this scrutinized process to actually release it. So it's probably now our. The total slaughter thing could be the thing that would cause us to fail this process, and we'll need to change some things to actually release it on the App Store. But the main reason I think was that we didn't have Mac, so like on top of the
Mac
fees,
and we didn't have iPhones to test, right? Because one thing is building the game, second thing is actually playtesting it. And at that time in Poland, it was quite rare to see an iPhone, I think, in our environment, let's say. So it wasn't so easy to just download it somewhere and play test it and see if everything is working after converting in Unity.
And with different mobile devices, because we actually pushed to the limit the number of touches and taps your screen can register, and different devices have different, let's say, limits. I think now it's easier to have a device that have like eight simultaneous things to be registered, but back then it wasn't really obvious and we had some issues, like everybody's clicking, like four people's clicking on the same screen, and at some point some of the taps are not registered as a because we have too many other fingers pressing the screen. So it would be additional also like a thing that we need to test for at iPhone platform in general. Yeah, but now I can't access it. Now I have iPhones and like I can't access it.
You know, do you want to know something pretty sad?
Yeah.
I can't access it either. It looks like the newest Android doesn't support it anymore. It told me that the app is not compatible. So I guess so... that's the end of Stellar Asylum.
We've run out of this.
Nice. I was getting spammed with some emails about updating, you know, in-app purchases and things like that for the 5 years, and it was still working somehow, even if we wanted to, we couldn't update the source code because it's a pile of shit. That's the first thing. It was built in a very old version of Unity right now. And I don't even know, do we have access to all the source code? Did you find it?
I don't think I didn't. I found some remake that we did at some point, but it was a new thing from scratch with assets, I think, updated.
Yeah.
But maybe I have it on a disk drive somewhere, because I had it on PC and maybe on an old disk drive that potentially I have in a different place.
Yeah.
I have it, but not currently available. Let's say to me, but that's also funny thing that you kind of, on one hand, it's nice that the thing in software can be built and then used, because if you have a device like a washing machine, it kind of expects the washing machine to work for some number of years, right? It can break physically, right? But if you have software program, on one hand, you would expect it to work forever, because why wouldn't it, right? If you have the same execution environment and you created a program and all things are backwards compatible, why wouldn't you why wouldn't you run it, right? After 20 years. But then there's the reality of software. And for example, Google Play, you mentioned that for 8 years you got spam with actually updating the documents and the requirements of different for different applications through the Play Store, not even related to source code, right? So it's it's not really you cannot really create an app, put it on Play Store and expect it to work after 10 years, right? Even though software could work it, and there's software like Emacs or Vim that are 20 years old and still run, but they're maintained by people.
And I think especially 8 years ago, the App Store was a bit of a Wild West, right? Not as much as 12 years ago or something, but still, we didn't go through any checks when posting the app, right? We didn't do any, I don't think they did any due diligence on whether our app contains any, I don't know, offensive material or things like that. But during the last 7 years after the release, I was getting, as I said, spammed, and I did 10 different occasions. I was updating the parental guidelines for different countries, you know, sometimes, all right, in Brazil, the law changed. Now you need to say whether your app contains alcohol references, because whether it does or not will affect the visibility in the Play Store. So things changed and things are now, I think, more thoroughly checked, I would imagine, on things like App Store and Play Store.
I think the two platforms are different in this regard that Play Store tries to make it automated, like the Android have it automated. So there are probably like static checks and they refer to the documents you need to press. But in general, the process seems to be automated. And on App Store, there is definitely a human being that is going through this, probably obviously with like a checklist to for things to check, but there is like a human behind the process that will need to verify the app. And I think this is it can be seen if you scroll through the apps available on App Store versus the apps available on the Play Store. You can see the difference in both in numbers and the quality that there's certain bar on App Store that they won't allow beneath this. Okay. And the other thing that we should talk about is the trailer. We've made the marketing and the advertising, and then the Kickstarter campaign also. Which of these we tackle first?
Yeah, so I think we can start with the campaign, right? Because the trailer was kind of part of it. I don't think we wanted to do a trailer outside of the Kickstarter campaign, so maybe we can start with that. Another brilliant idea by us. We are making our first game with pretty questionable quality, and we are like, all right, let's make a Kickstarter campaign for it. Kickstarter wasn't available in Poland at that time, but we had our alternative, which was called Wspieram to, and it worked in a pretty much the same way as Kickstarter. So we can just refer to it as Kickstarter, I think. And we set up a very, very low goal, right, for the amount of money. I think it was like 5,000 Polish zlotys, which is 1,200 US dollars. And one thing that I remember is that we were super vague with how we are going to spend this money because we wanted from this money we wanted to fund the application process for the developer account, which was $100, right? Then we wanted to fund some marketing efforts from it as well, right? We weren't really getting money, at least in our heads, we weren't getting money for us. We were kind of trying to get money for some sort of proper launch or marketing. We didn't
I
really
mean,
have
we
any.
wanted, yeah, we wanted to like square even, right? With all of the fees that we needed to do for and wanted to do to have like a little bit of market visibility for as far as the marketing goes, the advertising goes. Yeah, and as you mentioned, the we ended up actually creating a trailer. So we needed to pay the costs for the person with the cameraman, and because we had like a dress up costumes, like then so we needed to paint for this. So it's like we didn't really like it wasn't the money that would go to Bahamas or like spend our time at beaches in Miami. It was like $1,000 US dollars for three persons that needed to pay a lot of fees. So
Actually, four, right? Because maybe we haven't mentioned it, but we had a fourth person kind of on a team who was our friend doing music. He wasn't involved from the beginning and he wasn't involved at the, I think, end during the release. But he made all the music and sound effects for our game, or maybe not all sound effects. Some of the sound effects were homemade by us. And the music also was featured in the trailer, so the trailer is still available on YouTube. You can check it out, and you can hear how the music sounds like. And I'm a big fan of the main theme and the only theme that we had in Stellar Asylum, right? I still think it's catchy. It's nice. It really fits the theme well. I
I
think
put I put the
Carol, our
links
friend, nailed it.
I put the links for all of the resources that we have to Star Asylum under the description of the podcast episode, so we'll have So everybody who's watching and listening have idea and like available for it to see here and like how the game looked like, to hear how the game looked mm-hmm. like. So no worries about that.
So we had a team, we used it in the game when we were playing, and then as well in the trailer. And the trailer we filmed in an apartment, right? Which was empty at that time, I think. It was an apartment that belonged to my parents. They were renting it, and luckily there was nobody renting it at that time. So we're like, yeah, that's going to be our movie set. And we basically had a table, a tablet, right? Like Samsung Galaxy something with the game on it. And then we had a makeup artist and an actual director slash camera operator of our trailer, who was also a friend, but he was already working in the industry kind of, so he was professional. The makeup artist was very professional as well.
Because like to we need to mention this if somebody like will listen to this but not see the trailer. The makeup artist wasn't to like brush up our like foreheads, but we had like full face, and not only face but like paint on faces and body to resemble other characters. So each of us, and actually now your wife, was playing Steven, so the cosmonaut, the astronaut with the bazooka, and each of us was painted to reflect, to star other characters. I had like rhino, so I had the nose for the rhino and was painted like full body, pretty much with arms.
Because the rhino nose was actually a prosthetic kinda. Yeah. And how did she attach it to your face? I don't remember it.
I don't remember, but it looked very professional. Like I still have the pictures, and because you recall we also had like a picture set, like Mikołaj,
photo shoot.
So we got like a couple of funny looking professional photos in this paint. So it was like, it was an adventure. Like,
And so, I was the monkey, you were the rhino. Our third team member, Kuba, was Todachi. He had a frog eyes painted on top of his eyelids.
Yeah.
So he would star with closed eyes so people could actually see the makeup on his eyelids. And then Anya was Steven Astronaut, the astronaut. In a motorcycle helmet, because we didn't have access to actual astronaut helmets, so we just got a black and white
It was good enough.
In the dark, you could maybe
potentially it was really better because it was dark, right? The black entirely. I think if you have like an astronaut thing, it's visible, so it was really like nice that because in the game you also don't see through this, so it's like you kind of she then like I'm not gonna spoil the trailer. So go.
Yeah, watch. But it is a bit of a mystery, right? Who is under the Steven's helmet?
Yeah.
It was, of course, we did narrative design as well, which was very limited. But we also really wanted to be special in some way and include some sort of like hidden narrative gags. So Steven, who sounds like a person, like a man, and acts like a humanoid person, when he was dying, like he was completely silent during the game. He didn't have any sounds apart from the death sounds, which really didn't sound like an actual human being, right? It sounded more like an alien goo or something like that. Yeah. So that's actually alien in a humanoid spacesuit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And during the trailer, we basically, there are shots of the parts where we play the game on this table with like our paint on and like the costumes on. And we have parts when we explain the game, like facing the camera and explaining the game. But I think it's in Polish, right?
Or not? Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it was for the Polish Kickstarter, so we did it in Polish.
Yeah, so it's maybe this part. Yeah, but it's like when I watch this now, I wonder, like, why aren't we smiling? Like, when you watch old photographs and everybody is like very, very like straight face and like treating this like as a serious thing, it's like we are making this and we want people to find it fun and like exciting. And like now it's so obvious and it wasn't obvious back then. We were like, oh,
I think we were
serious.
Yeah. I think we got actually, like, Miko, I was actually trying to tell us to kind of cheer up, but I think we were just stressed out of our minds. You can hear it in our voice. We are trembling and...
Yeah. Yeah.
I think it was just the first thing for, like, the same thing with programming and making a game was a first time experience for us, but we kind of had some background for it, right? We did some projects together. We were already at university. But when it comes to marketing and releasing the game, that was a completely unknown area for us. And I think we were, at least I, was really struggling with that part. Both video, both the campaign, like the Kickstarter campaign that we did. I'm not the type of a marketing person, I think. I'm not the type of person who would show the work and be super proud about it, even though it's the first game they've ever did in their life, and sell it to other people. So I remember this experience as a constant struggle with it, right? With internal voice saying, come on, it's not good, it's not amazing, and people are actually laughing at it and things like that. But yeah. It was just like...
Yeah, but that's like
a personal thing.
Yeah, yeah. And like, you know, this was our first project. So we needed like, I think it's kind of obvious for that we have issues with our also confidence and like marketing part. I think our maybe personalities are not also the marketing personalities, like the best personalities for a marketing job. And I think it's quite common in the game industry. That are people that are willing to, for example, spend years of their life like in front of the computer making the game they love. But when it comes to communicating these ideas and like why they are loving it, like why they are pursuing this for years, they struggle, right? Like even in front of the people they know. So I think it's quite important thing to like realize this. And you as a person that you're creating a game, you'll need to be confident about talking about this game, why it matters to you. Like if it matters to you, it probably may matter to other people, right? So it's like you need to like start somewhere. And I think it was nice for us, like we started somewhere, right? Like we could just bail out at some point and say like, nah, we're not gonna do it. But I think we pushed through this, even though we were scared shitless. Yeah. We pushed through this, and with the help actually of Mikołaj, I think, like he kind of, Mikołaj, so the person with the director and the camera operator, he was like realizing that we're very like anxious and like we don't know what we're doing. And he helped us in general to keep like high spirits and to push through this and made this trailer. To make this trailer and then the campaign. Because this was pretty much, I think, for us, it was kind of equal that if we get this trailer, we get the campaign. If we don't make the trailer, we will not have a chance of making a campaign.
Yeah, because campaigns on Kickstarter, I don't know if it's like this now, but at that time on the Polish one as well, basically the only thing that was featured was the video, right? And of course, underneath the video was the whole campaign description explanation. But the main thing, the featured piece of media was the video.
Yeah.
So for us, making the video was the most important. I want to actually talk a bit about what you touched upon before, because I think it's an interesting topic about the, you know, one person working on a game for longer time and not being able to explain. I think it's a a bit of a survivorship bias that is kind of hurtful for a lot of people, because we talk a lot about this one person video game, right? Or video games that were made mostly by one person, and things like Stardew Valley, right? Or Undertale. Those are the stories about determined video game developers who pushed through, who were surviving for, you know, barely any money, eating scraps, and then they published a game which was very successful. But nobody talks about thousands and thousands of solo game developers or small teams that don't make it, right? And it's, I think we also kind of fall into the category of people who are believing this, the game will gonna defend itself, right? So if you made a good game, people will play it, people will talk about it, you know, somebody will bring it to their, I don't know, school, and they're gonna play it on the break, and everything is gonna be fine, right? The word of the mouth will work for us. But that's not the case with games anymore. Maybe it was the case for games 40 years ago, right? But nowadays it's completely different. Of course, still, there are some games, some people who achieve success, but they are just a drop in the ocean of all the people who don't really put effort in marketing and in building the community. And then they expect that, you know, people will just admire the game for what it is. But if people won't hear about the game, that there's going to be nobody to admire it, right?
Yeah. Yeah, this is why you can also see the shift in the GDC subjects. Like half of the GDC talks, at least now, they're related to self-publishing, how to do it to make your game stand out on Steam, how to do proper Steam page, like artworks for the game, how to do it. Because like recently you can go to Steam, for example, and look up in the browser Steam upcoming releases, and you'll get a full like page when you get like 20 or 30. I did this, I think, 2 days ago. You get like 30 or 40 games each day that they have planned date to come out on this date. And this is just like a percentage of all of the games that are being planned to like go public in this way. Just they these are the people who actually made the Steam page already, because they were confident enough and had like a couple of screenshots or even like a quick trailer that they showed, right? So like the amount, like the sheer number of games that are being released is just like staggering now. So
yeah.
In order to be visible to other people, like the games will not really defend themselves. Maybe you need, like, now there are like lots of strategies how to do that, to partner with streamers and YouTubers to have the game featured, and then on the day of the launch you do like a live broadcast of this yourself as a developer, and all of these strategies, like they're there to make this game visible. And yeah, it's really,
and
it's
we didn't
really
do any of that, right?
Yeah, well, this was like, you know, a learning experience for us, right?
Yeah.
This is also,
and I think this is maybe my only kind of regret about Stellar Asylum. I think, of course, game was not great. It was nice. It was playable. It shipped. It was super nice that it shipped with all the problems that we had. We did the campaign, and the campaign actually, like, we got some money. So we were able to pay for marketing, to pay for the trailer, to pay for Google license, and to do some stuff. I think we did like one small event in a gaming cafe where we showed the game to like 10 people in total.
Yeah.
And so all of that. But then after launch, maybe we can talk about launch in a second. But after launch, we kind of got discouraged, right? We were like, all right, nobody's downloading the game. What do we do now? We don't know. So maybe we just stop doing anything and just let it kind of go away. And I think it would be a nice thing to push. Of course, it wouldn't have great effect. I'm aware of it. Like, nobody's first game, or pretty much nobody's first game, is achieving a great success, right? But at least we would have tried. And I kind of regret that we haven't tried doing some marketing, some more live events somewhere, just in our home city, you know, showcasing it somewhere, posting the social media posts in different channels.
Yeah, it's also like difficult. I mean, you probably also might recall that we're quite tired, like, because this was really like the anxiety was also kicking in, and like we felt this, even though like on one hand nothing is really happening, like you know, like we're releasing the game and like nothing bad will happen if like it's not like, but it was really important to us, right? Because we spend a lot of time and effort working on this game. So like as usual in game dev industry, the last months, I think it wasn't really like very cheerful for us, because we needed to do a lot of stuff done, get a lot of stuff done. And then, yeah, so this is what I recall from this like post-launch thing, that like after we launched, kind of remember that we felt, at least I felt like tired and wanted to have it like a break from this for some time. But it's, yeah, I think it's a bad way to think about the launch now. Like, it was really a thing that if now when I think about Stellar Asylum, what we did back then, I'm really proud. Like, the amount of like stuff that we did for this game, we learned pretty much programming on this game. We did like really interesting parts, and it was like enriching experience in so many ways, like both the marketing part, both the actual making this technically speaking, both like teaming up and pushing through the hard times, like all of this stuff, and with the campaign and with the trailer. It's so much stuff we have done, and it's really, we shouldn't back then feel bad about it. Like, I don't think like the results of not having like 100 downloads a day or an hour after launch shouldn't really discourage us from the achievements that we have made personally, right?
Yeah. But as you said, right, this is how we look at it now. The same thing for me. I'm really proud that we did it, and just proud of how the game kind of played out and the experience. Like, we still sometimes play it just for, you know, for nostalgia, and it works, right? It works. But at the time, after launch, we just felt exactly the stress, anxiety, and seeing that it didn't pick up immediately, we got discouraged very quickly.
Yeah.
And it took then few years to actually understand how cool and great the experience of making it was.
It's like, imagine like back then, like now kind of, you know, we slipped back into, like, say, the usual life of ours, and we there's like less things, I think, that we do outside of our, like, let's say, usual routines. And it was really amazing, like, because we mentioned, and we didn't talk about it more, we organized an event in a local cafe. I think it was the most, let's say, famous cafe in Kraków, in Poland.
Gaming cafe,
Gaming cafe with the board games, but also they had like PlayStations, right? But I think the emphasis was on board games. So we wrote the email to them saying that we want to like a host like a mini event. Would they be like okay with that? And we set up, we took like proper tablets. I think we've done this like that, if people will beat one of us in like 1v1, they get free beer or something. Like, this was, it was like, it was crazy. Like, even if 10 people like had a chance to meet this, like, it didn't really cost us anything, right? Like, we didn't really like pay. Like, we didn't have like, you know, like grand marketing, but we just talked to other people and had a chance to meet them. I think we really had like a long-standing friendship out of this, but like the a chance to meet those people, and then like probably they would download the game later and show their friends. This was really like a nice thing that we did. And it was pretty much, we kind of like did this at random in some sense. Like the idea for this was like, it wasn't like a script that we're following. And it was like, we did this, and we have to do this. Like it was really like, for me now, like looking at this, it's really nice. And like, I am really proud that we've done this, all of these things, right?
Mm. Yeah. How long? Yeah, and the oh yeah, go for it.
Yeah, yeah, go on.
No, I just wanted to talk about the the thing that we kinda we went against the common thing to do, which is when you start making a game or just doing game dev, you make a clone of an existing game, right? Or you make a small, simple game that you don't release, you don't plan to release it, you just make it and it's an experience, you forget about it and you make another one which is better than the first one. This is what everybody used to say, this is what everybody is saying right now. This is an advice I would probably give a person who is starting, but we did something completely different. What do you think about it? Why was it a good choice or...
Yeah, I think it's an interesting one because like on one hand, if you want to learn how to program, you probably want to do this in a quick iteration, like you commit, for example, 2 days or a week to do like a mini project, then you throw it away and you start over. But on the other hand, if we were to do this, we probably wouldn't have finished and wouldn't have gone so far with Stellar Asylum. Mm. Like, we wanted to create a game, not really learn how to do games, right? Mm. And
yeah,
this like shared vision of making and finishing this game was needed to push through all of these like hoops. And without it, we wouldn't do all of these things, like a trailer for it and like this meeting in a cafe. And now I wouldn't say, it's always issue with giving advice. Like it really depends on what you're at and what you want to do. But in general, having a vision that is really like cohesive and other people are in this vision with you, it's really helping you to push through. And I think we actually have, even though like right then it was like an amazing and great project, like the size of this project was immense for us back then because we had no experience. Now to make this project, I think we could like do this probably in less than a month, given assets it probably would be like 2 weeks of work, right? If like full-time work. So it was really, you know, if you want to like try and make things, it's probably better to have some skills. So like not to learn everything at once, but having a game that you believe in, like a project that you believe in, and then you push through to actually publish it and release it. But trying to be, I think, more emotionally detached from the success of this game, because this is, I think, what got us in the end. Might have been a better idea. So you kind of need, but you then need to do like two things at once. On one hand, believe in this project, and then like be emotionally detached. So it's like
really difficult. That's because I wanted to say exactly this. We did believe in this project, right? Throughout the development of the game, we're like, this game is nice. It's fun to play. We play it with our friends during, you know, breaks between courses and university. We imagine playing this game in our school a year or two before. So we got really emotionally attached to it, as you said, but that's also what kept us going. This is what made us not give up on the project, not start it kind of from the scratch, because at some point it was so much bad code, bad approaches, bad just software patterns, that it would be much easier to just start from the scratch. But because we wanted to see it live, we wanted to finish it, we wanted to share it with our friends, we pushed through.
I don't know if we can like crystallize an advice out of this. I think both approaches are nice. I think there are unfortunately like maybe this our approach can be is definitely more emotionally taxing. So like I can imagine a lot of people, for example, spending years on their games and then like the game flops and they're really like we should say that for us this game was an after hours activity during studies, right? So it wasn't, we didn't depend both like financially and we didn't depend financially on this, right? So it's not as grave for us. It wasn't as grave for us as it can be for other people. So probably you want to have some real experience. So it's useful to create some smaller projects if you want to do like really like indie game, a solo developer work. So that's definitely like the thing to do. But if you want to create a game in your spare time and you really believe in this like vision and have some nice ideas, having some friends collaborate with you and do this when you're really like trying to push through this, despite all of the, for example, issues that come up, it like, yeah, like to visualize this for people who can understand, like who know how to code, like we didn't know loops enough that we created, for example, four if statements for each of the prisoner when we wanted to do something. So imagine this type of code across all of the database, and then you need to create like a change that will influence all of these parts. Like it was very difficult and like like it was like really tough at some point to introduce new changes, to add new features, to close features that were still, let's say, open. So yeah, I think both approaches have the merit. You need to like understand that like if you're really going to be financially dependent on this project, you don't want to create like your first game and spend 5 years on it by like not getting any like income or something. But if you're doing the project and it's also like scope of the project, I think is really important in this part, right? Because we after all made Stellar Asylum in 1 year, right? Which is not, I would say it's quite small for a game. I mean, you can do like these types of games with you know, when you know the tools for like in weeks or months. But if I wouldn't plan for anybody to go for like 2 year long project as a first game, right?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I agree, and I think that it would have been better for us to do a small game project, the three of us, for a month, with set expectations that we weren't gonna release it, and then start working on a Stellar Asylum. I think it would be beneficial for many different ways, and by learning stuff and knowing what not to do, the journey on the Stellar Asylum would be easier, right? Maybe less interesting, but easier. I think that's what that's the idea behind the study course that I did here in Denmark. It was the Dadu University project, and this is a half year course, but you develop three games during it. You develop first game in 2 weeks with the whole team of like 15 to 20 people. Second game, another 2 weeks. And then the actually graduation game for the rest of the time. So it's basically two very short iterations, two games that are super bad. Like our first game was insanely bad. Like things didn't even have textures because we didn't have time to put them in. So like 2 hours before making a final build, I was in panic adding some random trees to the level so the level is not fully empty. So it was a disaster, right? But then you make a second game, also for 2 weeks, and it actually looks like something. And then you make a graduation game and you use all those experiences to do something that actually is a game.
Yeah,
and I think having this approach is it just saves you so much time on mistakes, and being able to do something and throw it out to the trash immediately after. It sounds bad. It sounds discouraging. And maybe at the time, I don't know how we would have reacted to this idea if somebody, for example, advised us to do it. But having all the experiences we've had, it would be a good thing to do, I think.
Yeah.
To start with something that is not for release, right?
Okay, because I thought, now I think this might be really a nice way of putting it. So, because I thought that we're debating, for example, whether we were creating Stellar Asylum in 1 month and like then moving on to another different project. Mm. So, for example, having this bright, you have like an idea that you're connected, emotionally connected with, and you want to make it. And then somebody is telling you, do this in 2 weeks and throw it out. Like, it's very discouraging, mm. right? But
yeah.
the idea would be
yeah.
not to do this as your first project, but
yes.
do something else before, right? And then start, for example, for 2 weeks, just do something similar. In our case, probably like a Mario clone for 2 weeks, which is
mm-hmm.
also 2D, has jump animations, so you need to think about how to do it, would be very beneficial. And then switching to Stellar Asylum to keep also, like, not to throw out the project that you want to see whether it works in the end, right? Like,
yeah,
okay,
exactly.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. Probably like a lot of issues that we had could be fixed this way. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, and we spent, I think, one year
mm-hmm.
on working on this, but it wasn't like full time also, so it was
mm-hmm.
like after hours, but our university wasn't really like intense, I think, to the degree that like
mm-hmm.
we had some time to work on it. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And then do you know how many downloads we got in the end last 6-7
no.
years?
No, I like
I
total...
checked it today. Yeah.
Ah, okay.
If you can take a wild guess.
In total. In total, how many
yes.
downloads?
Yes.
I would say 300.
Almost 6,000.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's some people actually stumbled upon this game. You know, the person who posted it on Reddit, the useless,
yeah.
the pointless slider, had to play the game.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, yeah. I wonder, I would love to see like the alternative universe and how, what would be our download rate, a download like total count, if we just had a play menu item called play instead of enter prison. And then if you'd play it, it would be 1v1, 1v all, or 2v2.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I
yeah.
just want to see how much confusion we brought to all the people that stumbled upon this and trying
yeah.
to figure out where is the game they downloaded.
Yeah. Yeah. And also one more topic at the end. We didn't have one person mode, right? We didn't have solo mode. This is also a very big thing
yeah.
that we realized afterwards, that when people download the game, they never have a second person next to them wanting to play the game with them, right? Especially mobile game. So having something, anything that they would let people play
yeah.
Alone would already have a huge benefit, right? But we didn't know. We were young, we were stupid.
Yeah, like thinking helps. I think that's the like
yeah.
thinking, you know, thinking yeah. helps. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Any other closing thoughts on this one?
It really teaches me so much. I've learned a lot from this experience, and even up to this date, sometimes some of the choices I make in my professional life, let's say, are somehow based in Stellar Asylum and what we experienced back then, because those were the actually hard learned lessons. It's not that somebody told me how it worked. It's not that as we talked about, we learned about some design patterns on university. I've stumbled upon things, it sucked, and then we find some sort of solutions, right? I know how hard it is to market a game, like a mobile game, how useless it is as an indie dev to put money into the marketing of on Facebook or on some other platforms. It's just not viable for you unless you have a big lump sum of money that you want to just waste.
Yeah, like you cannot do it. This is like one maybe a thing that you should mention, that like if you think you want to advertise the game on like using ads, like Facebook ads, Reddit ads, you should know that like ideally the bigger the return is like below 1/10%, like the click through ratio. So like you need to imagine that you're paying for example 1,000 impressions some amount of dollars. And like the players, the big players, they pay, for example, like 10 million or $100 million to get the return on the investment for like 100 million and cap $15,000. Like this is the let's say ratio that you're speaking with. So like people have already like computed this game to this degree that like the click-through ratio are so small that you need to throw in a large sum of money to the advertising in order to get people to download it. And with each step, like the ratio of people to doing diminishes. So like, let's say 2,000 people will see your ad, then like 100 people will click on it, then like 3 people will download it, and like 1 person will play the game, and like nobody will buy the thing. So it's like you need to be really prepared to do the math, like what is the like this funnel and what is the actual ratio of people that will be able to like get into this game. So yeah, but closing thoughts.
Just great learning experience, something that I still, when I was applying for a random job, it wasn't even a game dev job, 2 or 3 years ago, still doing my university degree, it was like a software engineering position for a student. I showcased Stellar Asylum during the interview. I was like, hey, I made this game, look, you can press here and it jumps and you can do stuff, and it still kind of works, right? It's a thing that we did, maybe not now when I'm actually working game dev and I have things to show that are properly developed games, but for a few years it was a project that is tangible, that you can showcase to people, that I was really proud of after all. So great journey, a bit of a downfall or a small hard times during the launch and immediately after release when we got discouraged, and then slowly understanding how valuable and how cool it was after some years.
Yeah, I could pretty much agree with all that you said. I can also add that like you shouldn't be discouraged by hard things in general, like and failure in general, because this is like needed for us to anybody to grow. So like without failing with Stellar Asylum, we wouldn't appreciate it now as much, I think. So pushing through and finishing things, even though it's tough and a lot of people, a lot of things are just falling apart, is a really important experience in general, because like, and this is like across industries, like it's both like things in military, in business, and like it's really important for you to like learn how to push through tough things, tough times. And like these projects, like game projects, are usually big, like they involve audio, visual parts, like artistic capabilities, technical capabilities, marketing capabilities. Like this is merging all sorts of like walks of life into one thing. But it's the more it is like difficult, the more it is rewarding in the end, right? Like, so it's really important that to exactly. Push through and yeah, I'm really happy that we did Stellar Asylum. Yeah.
Likewise.
Okay, thank you very much, Kacper, for talking to me. It was a pleasure.
Thank you as well. Thank you for having me. Yeah. It was great. A bit nostalgic and
a love letter.
Great to revisit the memories. Yeah.
A love letter to Stellar Asylum. I think it's
and our younger selves.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you so much. Take care.
Thank you. See you.